In the aftermath of Steve Witkoff's visit to Moscow with President Putin, a lot of people have been trying to figure out what now. There's some great video that came out of this, a lot of smiles. President's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was involved. They had a lot of video of them walking around in the city. But at the end of the day, nothing happened. It was about 5 hours worth of conversation. So a lot of things were discussed in there, but both sides really came out saying, we're not going to talk about anything that happened here during this meeting. So there's no alleged outcome. But as our next guest wants to tell us, that doesn't mean it was a waste of time, though it might not be a good idea in the way you may be thinking. We have Dr. Jennifer Cavanaugh back with us today, Senior Fellow Director of Military Analysis at Defense Priorities and Strategic Thinker par excellence. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, listen, one of the things I'm eager to have you on today, because you kind of put a good strategic, not spin, but I guess you kind of characterize things in ways that too often, you know, people are just looking at what happened today and what does this mean right now and what's going to happen tomorrow, et cetera. But sometimes we need to, that's not necessarily the right lens to look at. We need to kind of back up and look at things from a strategic point so we can see where we may actually be going. And that's one of the things you've published a couple of things here recently, and one in Unheard and another one in Responsible Statecraft, which I think really captures what we need to know right now. And so I want to get right into those. First of all, in Unheard, I guess it was about a week or so ago, you published a piece here that Gary's about to throw up there called Moscow Talks Exposed the Fantasy of a Fair Peace Deal. And of course, there's almost ad nauseum we hear from both Zelensky and Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, and certainly Keir Starmer about we need a just and lasting peace as defined by Kiev. And of course, we don't seem to get there, but we talk about it a lot. But now then, these talks may be exposing that that's actually a fantasy. And you said that there are three things that this really exposed. And so I'm wondering, first of all, what led you to write this article here? And you know, what is the fantasy?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge the progress that's been made, even if it's small. And I think that people are focused on whether or not a deal came out of the meeting in Moscow, and obviously one did not. And there's a focus on whether the past 2 weeks, the 28-point plan, the 24-point plan, the 19-point plan, whatever plan we're on now, you know, whether this was all wasted time or whether we actually moved closer to an end to the war. And I think, in my view, the biggest benefit from the past 2 weeks has been that it's forced people to grapple with the reality that any deal is going to be a bad one. There's no just peace. There's no deal that's going to be celebrated in Kyiv as a win. And that's unfortunate and it's unfair, but it's the reality. And I think the sooner that the international community, the United States, Europe especially, come to grips with this fact, the easier it will be then to start talking about, well, what's the best deal that we can get that leaves Ukraine sovereign and free, as Marco Rubio said, and secure for the long term, but that is also acceptable enough to Russia that they're willing to stop fighting.
And even before we get into the 3 points that you bring up in this article, I want to kind of run backwards a little bit to the Anchorage meeting, because I think we had kind of a similar setup there. In fact, I think there was a lot more optimism because it was Trump and Putin physically meeting. And I know a lot of the buzz was that we were really close to something, and Trump himself kind of fed into that saying, we'll have a tripartite meeting with me and Zelensky and Putin and all this, and we'll have that, you know, coming up soon. And obviously literally nothing came out of that. Do you think that there was some unreasonable expectations then that we maybe should have already learned these lessons?
I mean, yes, but these are tough things to accept. You know, we've been in a world for a long time where principles like might doesn't make right, and territorial sovereignty, and other parts of the rules-based order have really dominated thinking about foreign policy. So returning to a world in which might does make right, and in which countries are able to seize territory by force, where things are not fair, where countries that are victim of aggression are forced to make uncomfortable sacrifices, This is a change, and it's not a change to something new. It's a return to the way the world has been for most of its history. I think the anomaly is really the post-World War II period, but it's still something that's difficult, I think, for people to grapple with. So I think all these meetings, the summit, the Alaska promises, all of this has been a process of getting to the point where not only the battlefield reality supports the deal, but also other stakeholders who are watching from the sidelines are ready to accept that the deal that we're working towards is not the fair, just peace that people talked about in 2022.
And, you know, one of the big differences, you mentioned the battlefield, that's different between the August Anchorage, Alaska meeting and this recently one that just happened here, and that is the city of Pokrovsk, because in August, there were some Russians around the outskirts of it, but the city was almost entirely still, the city limits itself was still entirely within Ukraine control, and now it has effectively been lost to the Ukraine side, and Mirnograd, its sister city, is completely surrounded. Does that change, does that move us closer to the recognition about what you're about to tell us about these three realizations?
Yeah, absolutely. The battlefield reality makes a difference. And I think for a long time, there was a hope that Ukraine could win or that Russia would run out of steam, but that's not happening. And I think as Russia slowly gains territory and the situation on Ukraine's front lines looks increasingly dire, there's concern that what we're seeing now is not just a war of attrition, but a rapid approach towards a collapse of the Ukrainian front lines, which could mean not only a battlefield collapse, but also a political collapse, especially given the corruption scandal and the pressures that Zelensky is facing as a result of that. And so at that point, when you're faced with this question of can Ukraine even survive, then the sacrifices that are required for a peace deal look a lot more tolerable, given the really undesirable consequence of continuing to fight, which could be, you know, the end of the Ukrainian state completely.
Okay, well, so given that setup, let's take a look at some of the three things you say were realized as a result of this meeting between Witkoff and Putin in Moscow. Number one, you say that there is no progress on the territory. There is no security guarantees, and there's no agreement on any of the sides between the sides of the Ukrainian armed forces. Now, what is that going to tell you about where the two sides are, and how are we going to get that resolved? Or is the whole, I guess, outcome of this the fact that that was acknowledged, that there's a difference between them?
Well, I think that there's a narrative that that progress is being made, that we're on a path to peace. And I think it's important to take a step back and recognize that the really hard work of getting to a deal hasn't even started. Mm-hmm. And so for me, one of the key lessons from the past 2 weeks is that there's a lot of talk about areas where there's agreement, and that's great. But the key issues, territory, Ukraine's military capabilities, security guarantees, these are things that keep getting punted and pushed off. And we saw that after the meeting in Geneva as well. There was this narrative that, well, we've agreed on so much. The Ukrainians and the United States have agreed on so much. There's just a couple of issues that we haven't dealt with yet. And those issues are territory and security guarantees and NATO membership. And of course, these are the core root causes of the conflict, the things that are the hardest to deal with. And the same thing, I think, came out of the Moscow meeting. Putin's advisor, Ushakov, made clear that some proposals were acceptable and some were not. Territory was among the ones that was not acceptable. So I think, in my view, a lesson here is that these high-level meetings aren't actually addressing these core issues. And that means that it's probably going to require a different negotiating strategy, working level talks at the technical level, where you can actually hash out the details of what types of guarantees does Russia need on NATO membership to believe that it's a credible commitment that that Ukraine will stay out. What are the military capabilities that Ukraine does need for its security? And what are the red lines that Russia will not accept? And would continue fighting rather than see Ukraine have. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I wanted to talk about those red lines. Yeah, Gary, if you could pull up that video we used earlier this week from, I think, Ruslan Stefanchuk, the speaker of the Rada, the Ukrainian Rada, because he was laying out what he had as his red lines. I'm going to get to that in a second, but let's look at the other half of that first. And that is on the Russian side. You had Sergey Lavrov has said recently, Putin himself said just a couple of days ago that the terms that he set in June of 2024 are still the same terms he's looking at today. And that was that they said that there would be no NATO, of course. There would be a neutrality status for Ukraine. There would be demilitarization, a limit on how many troops were there, a denazification on the troops itself. And then, of course, there was the territorial submission of the four administrative oblasts, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Luhansk, and then Kherson. So that's where they said that they were then. So they said that there's no giving in on that. And I haven't seen any evidence, and I don't see any evidence that Russia will be compelled to go off of that statement. Now, I think you can probably understand that. Gary, let me know when you have that. Just give me a thumbs up down there when you have it, so I'll know when to go to it. First of all, let's look at that. Do you see anything that could compel Russia to go off of those demands?
That could compel Russia to go off? I mean, probably not. I think, though, that Putin has made it clear that he's going to continue fighting until he can achieve his objectives. And I think right now the Russians are very confident. They have a significant battlefield advantage. They believe that they have the upper hand in negotiations, which is probably true. And they don't see a reason to settle because they believe a better deal is still out there. At some point, they may decide that that's not the case, that continuing to fight isn't yielding any more ground for them, that isn't giving them any more advantages. It could be military factors that lead them to that conclusion. It could be economic factors that lead to that conclusion. But ultimately, I think they'll continue fighting until they can minimally meet those criteria. But that doesn't mean that all of them will be taken to the extreme. We've already seen some compromise on the four oblasts, right? Like they want all of Donetsk and Luhansk, but they're willing to maybe freeze where the current lines are in the others. I think on military capabilities, when they say demilitarization, I don't think that Putin is thinking Ukraine would have no military. And there's probably room for negotiation around what those capabilities that Ukraine would have and what the caps necessary to meet Russian demands would be. So I think there's some flexibility. Similarly on denazification, I think that's a very vague term. It's not exactly clear what it means. I think probably that could be met with guarantees for Russian language and the Orthodox Church and Russian minorities. So I think that even though each of these demands, each of these boxes will have to be ticked, there's probably some flexibility in some of them in terms of what it would take to meet Putin's criteria.
We've actually had some of our guests on and some information coming out of Moscow that that issue on the that was reported, especially in the Western media, that there was some willingness to be flexible on the Kherson and the Kharkiv, Kherson and the Zaporizhia Oblast. Apparently the Russians are saying, no, that's not true. There's no flexibility on that. At least so far, they're saying publicly that they're still holding on to all four of the administrative borders. But that's what they're saying. Now, the interesting thing is on the other side. The Russians have the military leverage where I think that at least up to this point, they can still say, maybe we won't give in on any of those major things. But then an interesting thing, last weekend, I think it was, the speaker for the Rada was talking almost like the Ukraine side was on the upper end, and they listed their red lines.
Ukraine is ready for substantive negotiations on ending the war, including at the level of leaders. At the same time, we must designate the Ukrainian red lines, which no one has the right to cross, neither physically, nor legally, nor morally. No legal recognition of the Russian occupation of Ukrainian territories. No restrictions on Ukraine's defense forces. No veto on Ukraine's right to choose its future alliances. Any genuine peace process must be based on a very clear principle: nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, and nothing about Europe without Europe.
Now, I think that last comment there was directed back at Washington, D.C., about nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine or Europe without Europe, because they weren't even present in Moscow on that meeting here. But the bigger issue, though, is those are pretty stark claims, and it is diametrically opposed from what the Russians are asking. So maybe that's the actual definition of your article there, is that this has exposed that there are irreconcilable differences between what the two sides are even trying to achieve. How do you overcome that?
Well, I mean, I think the Ukrainian position stated there is extremely maximalist. And my understanding is that at least in the negotiating table, the Ukrainians have indicated a little bit more flexibility. The terms that were just articulated, I think, are completely unachievable. That's just not going to happen. I think, number one, battlefield reality will set the tone. Ukraine cannot hold out forever. It cannot dictate the terms when it's losing on the battlefield. So ultimately, it will have to make some compromises. Now, I'm not suggesting that Ukraine must capitulate or surrender to Russia, but like compromise will be required, and that will be determined in how much compromise will be determined in part by who has the battlefield advantage. But ultimately, I think this is where I think the United States could play actually a significant and helpful role, and that is in helping to bridge the two sides. Any deal is going to be painful for Ukraine to accept. But there are things that Russia wants that the United States has, and the United States can use its own leverage to try to reduce the costs that Ukraine has to pay. And that means creating flexibility on some of the issues like Ukraine's military capabilities, and making sure that Ukraine does have what it needs to defend itself going forward. It can do things to protect Ukraine's ability to join the EU, to cooperate, have defense cooperation with European countries on a bilateral level. I'm not talking about as part of NATO, but as just with countries that are in Europe, having defense industrial base cooperation. So I think there is a future in which Ukraine goes on to be a militarily capable, secure, and prosperous country that is smaller than it was, unfortunately, in 2022, but that does have a good future. And the United States can help make sure that the terms of the deal allow for that path to continue to be open, even if they are also responsible for pushing Ukraine to accept politically difficult compromises.
And what is the risk to making statements like this? Because it was echoed maybe even later on the same day by Zelensky himself about what they're not going to accept. And you can say, well, they're just trying to posture for negotiations, so they're starting out big knowing they're going to have to give back. But then there's the risk that, number one, they've been saying this from the outset. They've never indicated that they're willing to give up anything, especially Zelensky. And if you keep saying that enough out loud, then isn't there a risk that the population itself will then feel, if you make these compromises later and you don't hold up for to those, that you're going to be you're going to be accused of being a betrayal of your own people? Isn't there a risk there?
There is a risk there. And I think that is why I believe that any deal that Ukraine takes will have to seem imposed by the West. It will have to seem like the United States forced Ukraine to accept a deal that appears to be a bad one. And that is really the only politically viable option. And even then, it's an option that probably means the end of the political career of whoever accepted it. Of course, the Russians know this, and they're worried about it too, because they don't want a leader who accepts the deal to then be voted out of office immediately, because then there's the question of does the deal even last? It also creates the risk that that ultimately what what Zelensky and others are promising is something they can't deliver. And on both sides, right? It's something they can't deliver what they've promised to the population, for sure. They also can't deliver whatever deal they accept. They can't impose those terms on their population or on their military. And then you have grounds for something much more serious in terms of a political collapse in the country.
Yeah, those are something I don't think you're given enough thought to by the participants here, whether in Washington or Brussels. Number two on your list of things here is you said that basically there's not going to be a fair peace as described by Kiev, as she's defined by Kiev. That message doesn't seem to be getting through, not just to the Ukrainian leaders, but to the European leaders. Here was Keir Starmer just a couple of days ago, about a week ago, I'm sorry, where he's talking about, hey, you know what? We're still going to get a just and lasting peace.
Over recent days, I've had detailed discussions with allies. I met the partners of the Coalition of the Willing during the G20, and I've spoken a number of times to both President Trump and President Zelensky, who I spoke to again earlier this morning. Mr. Speaker, we're united in wanting a ceasefire and a permanent end to the horrendous suffering that this war has brought to Ukraine. I have always said our aim must be a just and lasting peace. And both of those words, Mr. Speaker, are important, just and lasting. So, Mr. Speaker, I welcome the continued efforts of the United States to end the war and stop the killing. The initial draft of the 28-point plan included points that were not acceptable, but also some very important elements that will be essential.
So there you have, that's good enough, Gary. There you have him saying, look, first of all, he said, we're still looking for a ceasefire. Nobody on the Russian side is even willing to contemplate that until there's a deal. But then he goes back again to that same phrase he uses all the time, a just and lasting peace, which of course is defined by terms that Kiev lacks. But I think it's pretty clear that that's not going to happen. And then your article seems to say the same thing. So where does that leave us?
Well, Europe is really sidelining itself from this whole conversation, in my view. You know, the 28-point plan came out, and it was, in my view, not a great plan. Not because I think that there's a better deal out there for Ukraine, just because it was bad in the wrong ways. I don't like the security guarantees that were included that tied the U.S. in. I think that the way that they dealt with the frozen Russian assets actually is not really beneficial for anyone. It doesn't actually meet a lot of Russia's demands, so I'm not sure that Russia would sign on to it. So in my view, that was just like the wrong deal. And I'm not afraid of bad terms, but if we're going to have bad terms, let's have them be the right bad terms. So, you know, I didn't like that plan, but then the Europeans followed up with their 24-point plan, which was like a total fantasy land. And it was just a total non-starter. It included a just ridiculous set of 24 points that made no sense. And in my view, that was, just made them sort of even more irrelevant to the conversation than they were before. Already the administration has shown that they're, you know, willing to move forward without consulting the Europeans. The 28-point plan was a complete surprise to the Europeans. And so they're ready to move forward without them. And the Europeans, if they're going to continue to hang on to this idea of a just peace, are just going to make themselves even more isolated and unwilling to participate. Now, part of this is that they don't want to talk to Russia. And that is, in my view, a strange decision to make when Russia is going to be on your border forever. And I don't understand this idea of, well, this country did something we don't like, so we're not going to talk to them. In my view, you know, diplomacy is what you do with your adversaries, not with what you do with your friends. Yeah. You don't need to have diplomacy with your friends. So, you know, in my view, the Europeans have kind of proven themselves to be divorced from reality here. Now, I do think that there are exceptions. For example, Alexander Stubb from Finland has said that, you know, Europe does have to come to the reality that there is going to be no just peace, that the peace that is accepted will be unfair and unpleasant. So there is and this is why I think the past 2 weeks have been important, because they've created the space for actually someone to acknowledge that. Now, it will take time for everyone else to get on board with this, but that's ultimately the direction things are moving. And the faster it gets there, the better, in my view.
And there was, I guess yesterday in the news, there was apparently some leaked words out of Der Spiegel where I think it was Merz and Macron were apparently warning Zelensky that you have to be careful that the U.S. may betray you and turn on you and all this. And I thought that was kind of curious coming this late in the process, ever since Trump came in, when he's been pretty much straightforward that he's looking for a way to get this thing over and he's not going to do a lot of things. He's already cut off, you know, giving anything to Ukraine. He's only selling things to the NATO, et cetera. So I'm not sure what they would mean by that, but I just thought that was kind of curious that it, to my view, it just kind of further either exposes that the Europe is disconnected from what's going on, not just in Moscow, but also in Washington. But it kind of, to your point there, I think it kind of sides on some further.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me like Europe isn't getting it. Europe still believes that they can, bargain with Trump and get him onto their side, that if they buy enough weapons or spend enough on defense, things are going to go back to the way they were under Biden. And that's just not the reality. Trump is a transactional guy, so he's going to take whatever you'll give him. And he's going to keep pushing for a better deal. But ultimately, the direction of travel here is that the United States is moving away from Europe and it wants out of Ukraine. And I think that there are guardrails here. I don't think Trump wants Ukraine to collapse. That is a bad outcome for the United States, partially because then it creates this sort of bleeding wound right on the borders of NATO. And even though the United States seems to be pulling back a little bit from the European alliance structure more generally, we are still in it. We are still a member of NATO. And so until that connection is fully severed, it is a liability for the United States. And I think Trump also worries about the political costs of having Ukraine collapse on his watch. He doesn't want to fight for Ukraine, but he doesn't want to be the president that lost Ukraine either.
Yeah.
There are guardrails to how far Trump will go. But ultimately, he wants this thing to be settled, and he's not afraid to push hard to get there. So the Europeans, the fact that they still believe they can kind of win Trump over, or that they're surprised at how this is playing out, to me is a little bit befuddling, because, you know, I'm not the only one who's been going to Europe and telling them, like, you know, you didn't win a bargain. Like, you haven't convinced Trump. Trump hasn't changed sides. Like, this is, his approach is the same. He's just looking for the best deal at any one time.
Europe hasn't learned that they don't have any leverage over Trump. One of the third thing he wrote in this article is that it may be that the United States, and I don't know if you mean Trump personally or just the country itself, also doesn't realize that it has limited leverage. And this is kind of a surprise to a lot of people, on either Moscow or Kiev. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's this idea that Trump can, by the force of his personality or force of will, force the war to end. And there's, you know, since the Gaza peace deal, there's been a lot of focus on whether or not the same model might work. And my point here is just, it's not, that same model is not going to work. The United States has incredible leverage over Israel and a lot of leverage over Hamas and Palestinian actors that it does not have in this conflict. It has almost no leverage over Russia. We've seen that time and time again. Sanctions don't really change Putin calculus. They impose economic costs, but that doesn't make him want to stop fighting. And military efforts to impose military costs have run into the limits of U.S. defense production, European defense production, and Ukraine's manpower shortage. So there's just not a lot the United States can do in terms of sticks to try to force Russia to stop fighting. There are incentives that you could offer. We can come to that after this about, you know, what the United States could do, but there's not a lot of leverage. There's also not infinite leverage over Ukraine. I think the United States has a lot more leverage over Ukraine than it does over Russia, because Ukraine does depend on the United States for weapons and intelligence sharing. But over time, it's gained some independence. It has its own defense production. Europe can fill some gaps, including in intelligence sharing. And so if Ukraine decided that whatever deal was being offered would leave it at an existential risk, it could decide to keep fighting. Now, could it keep fighting for a long time? Probably not. But would a political leader possibly make that choice anyway if the deal was just seemed completely untenable? Possibly. Stranger things have happened. Even in U.S. history, decisions are made about use of military force that seem incomprehensible from a military or strategic perspective, but they're made because of political realities. And the same thing could happen in Ukraine. So I think it's important to recognize that any deal that's ultimately accepted will have to be both minimally satisfactory to Russia and palatable enough to Ukraine that the United States can use what leverage it has to coerce Ukraine to accept it. And that's a very narrow path. There's not a wide band. I think such a deal exists, but it will require, I think, more significant trades and efforts to navigate the sort of narrow space between these two players than went into the 28-point plan.
And it doesn't appear, just from what we've been seeing publicly anyway, that the administration has put much effort into the other half of that equation. You certainly put a lot in on the Russia side, trying to get them to come to some kind of an agreement. But we don't seem to be putting much effort at all in even trying to get the Europeans or the Ukrainians on our side. And I think that's, I guess, kind of exposing one of the bigger issues here. So the whole thing, this whole Unheard article that you had here said, you know, there was some utility in this. Meeting in Moscow because it exposed three things that we need to understand. But then it's something you wrote about a week or so before that in Responsible Statecraft, said that, look, we also need a new strategy. You know, that's kind of like the other half of it. So what is the new strategy that you argue that we need?
So my strategy here, my idea is that, you know, sticks don't work. But the United States does have some things that Russia really wants. Russia can win on the battlefield or achieve its battlefield objectives, probably. If it fought long enough, it could take enough territory. It would take a while. It would have a high cost. But that ultimately won't satisfy Putin's objectives. It won't address the NATO membership question. It won't address the broader European security architecture question. It won't result in normalized ties with the United States or reduced sanctions. So there's a risk for Putin, that he continues to fight for so long that the United States ultimately walks away and decides that to let Russia and Ukraine continue to fight, but actually not offer any of the political things that Russia wants that the United States has. So in my view, that's the ultimate leverage for the United States, is that Putin cares about these details. The United States just wants the war to end. What I suggest doing is, instead of using sticks, using these things that Putin wants as carrots, make a package and say, look, we'll talk about NATO membership for Ukraine. You know, we'll commit to keep Ukraine out of NATO. We will have a discussion about European security architecture. We will give you sanctions relief. We will normalize ties. But these things are time limited. You have, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 1 month, whatever the time frame is. After that, you can keep fighting, and maybe we'll talk about these other things, but we can't guarantee it. And then you force Putin to make a trade between his sets of objectives, his territorial objectives, and the broader political things that he wanted when he started this war. And that to me could be a tough choice for him. And by putting it in those terms, you could then force an earlier end. Now, that's not going to save Ukraine. It's not going to make the deal good. It's not going to make it a fair peace or a just peace. But it could result in a lasting peace that comes sooner than the current strategy.
And at a lower cost in blood. What do you say to those, or how would you rather propose to make that palatable to the West? And that means both inside the United States, and there's a lot of people, a lot of headwinds against this, as well as Europe, that would say, oh, that's just a capitulation to Putin. You're rewarding him for aggression and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I would say two things. First, I would say that Russia has already paid dearly for its decision to invade Ukraine. Enormous casualty rates in terms of people who are killed and injured, high economic costs. Its economy is stable, but not doing great. It is burned through very deep stockpiles of munitions and other military equipment. It now faces a rearming Europe. We'll see how much they rearm, but still some rearming. And even, you know, the future Ukraine is going to be anti-Russia, probably pretty well armed and more integrated with the West in terms of defense industrial base than it was before the war started, even if it doesn't join NATO. So ultimately, its security situation is worse. It's also lost influence with a lot of its satellites. It's now much more dependent on China. It has less influence in Central Asia and the Caucasus. So ultimately, it's paid a pretty high price. And in that sense, it's unfair or incorrect, I think, to say that you're rewarding him. He's already paid. But the second point is that, yes, it is unfair that any deal will give Putin the things that he wants. But this is the world of, you know, power politics. And as a realist, I do not like that this is how the world is going to war is going to end. But I accept that this is how the war is going to end.
And of course, one of the things I argue all the time is that the only reason we're in this unpleasant situation where we don't have a good outcome is because we've rejected all the other diplomatic off-ramps that were evident even before 2022. So that's a separate issue there. But the problem is we are where we are. And the question is, how's it going to be resolved here? And I can see your point there that Russia could, meaning that there is at least some limited leverage that the Trump administration has, because there are some incentives that he can provide Russia that would keep them from having to go to the full maximalist, because that doesn't leave them with some of these issues addressed. Like you said, like the NATO, no NATO declaration, et cetera. If they just go to a military victory, we'll have to see how they calculate whether it's worth it or not. I guess that's what's going to have to be dependent. What is your assessment? I won't ask you to prognosticate or guess, but as best as you can assess from what has happened up to this point and what the two sides are saying after this Witkoff meeting, when might we see the next time we arrive at a possibility where we'll find out if anybody's paying attention to these points that you've mentioned?
I mean, I do think that we're entering sort of an end game here. I don't agree with people who think that this war could go on for, you know, 5 more years. I think it will last through the winter. But I could see more serious negotiations starting in the spring, especially if Russia continues to gain territory and is closer to achieving at least its territorial objectives in Donetsk. I think that the situation in Ukraine is very unstable right now. So one thing to watch is how that unfolds. Does the political situation stabilize now that Yermak is out? Does the corruption scandal continue to widen? What kind of pressure does the United States put on Ukraine going forward? I think those are important questions to watch, because I don't think that Putin will compromise on his points. So I think it's ultimately about when is Ukraine weak enough or ready to start seriously discussing some of the compromises that will have to be made. Yeah, and then it will be up to the US, I think, to buffer a little bit those consequences. So it'll take both a little weakening of Ukraine and a US willingness to step in and absorb some of the costs so that it's not quite as painful for Ukraine to accept.
Yeah. And as long as that has nothing to do with any security guarantees, I'm all for that.
Yeah, I too am very anti-security guarantees. So that's my number one priority, is whatever peace deal, it should have no long-term commitments from the United States. And if there's a word security guarantee in there, I'm not happy about it.
I'm not good with that either. So, yeah, I think we're of one mind on that one. Thank you so much for coming on today, Jennifer. Always a pleasure to have you on and providing these viewpoints, especially at the strategic level, we just don't get enough of in our daily discourse. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And we appreciate you two guys as well. Thank you for being with us today. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't before you left, and we will look forward to seeing you on the very next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.